Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 23, and I am joined by Robert Bernasconi today, who is Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of Philosophy here at the Pennsylvania State University. He has recently given his inaugural lecture entitled "The Nature, Culture, Race, A Phenomenological Perspective on Critical Philosophy of Race." And I thought Brady Bowman did such a nice job of introducing you on your inaugural that I thought I'd quote from Brady's last two paragraphs of his introduction and giving him full credit for that. Because he gave a lot of thought to what he said at the beginning, and I thought it was a nice testimony to your work. So Robert Bernasconi is the author of over 150 published articles on figures from Locke and Hobbes to Kant, Hegel, Heidegger, Levinas, Sartre, Fanon, Derrida, and Nelson Mandela, to name but a few. These articles have addressed issues ranging from time, history, and language to ethics, legal theory, justice, poverty, the phenomenology of racism, the history of biology, the social ontology of the ghetto, globalization and world hunger, the history of philosophy, and the culture of genocide. There is a unity in this multiplicity which a mere enumeration cannot convey. A picture emerges in which existentialism, phenomenology, the history of philosophy and science, and the critical philosophy of race repeatedly cross paths in unexpected and fruitful ways. Surely it is accurate to say that Robert's work is situated at the intersection of these multiple lines of critical inquiry. In an important sense, however, it is truer to say that Robert's work is the intersection of these diverse practices of inquiry that is itself the ongoing emergence of their unity. Those were the words of Brady Bowman, and I thought they nicely captured something of your work, Robert. So welcome to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. And I thought we'd start out by talking a little bit about what you were trying to achieve with your inaugural, and if you could give us a kind of basic outline of the argument, which you did so nicely in the in the inaugural itself.
Right. Well, thank you. It was a great struggle to decide what to talk about for an inaugural. Because I wanted to bring together a lot of my different interests, but because I was hired to teach critical philosophy of race, and because there was a lot of uncertainty as to what critical philosophy of race is, I wanted in some way to address that issue for the audience without talking about critical philosophy of race. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do critical philosophy of race in a way that showed both how it was relevant to a lot of people who might not have thought that their work intersected with critical philosophy of race. Mm-hmm. In other words, I wanted to show that critical philosophy of race is not some marginal side of philosophy, like philosophy of, I mean, I don't want to insult anybody, like philosophy of sports, it's dangerous always. But you know,
sure.
I mean, but it's to show that it really touches on very central issues and at the same time challenges the way we approach those other issues. Mm-hmm. So that I see critical philosophy of race as being a challenge, not just to the content of what we do as philosophers, but also to our methodologies, in a way that one might say certain feminist work has done. And so that was the goal. To what extent I accomplished it, I don't know. But what I decided to do was to look at the fight against racism, because clearly that is the central motivation for doing critical philosophy of race. And I looked at one of the dominant arguments that is used to challenge racism, the argument around the nature-culture distinction, and tried to show that although it's been very productive in a limited sphere, that sphere is only very limited, and that therefore we need to re-examine how we can fight against racism from within the academy.
Well, and I thought you did a really nice job not only contextualizing the problem historically and showing how it has really deep roots for us from the perspective of the history of philosophy, but also that you were able to draw on the phenomenological tradition and even the American pragmatic tradition in a nice way that made it really appropriate as an inaugural for a department like Penn State, where we really try to embody this pluralistic approach that takes the continental tradition very seriously, brings it into dialogue with American pragmatism, classical American tradition, and then also now has added this really rich and robust component of critical race, critical philosophy of race, which I think, as you nicely put it, fits so beautifully with the other strands of our strength.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that Penn State is perfectly poised to do it. We have such a wide range of expertise here, and also the students, which is what makes it exciting.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, we heard a couple of them a few episodes ago on the Digital Dialogue. We had Nicholas Parra and Axel Carrera on, and they were wonderful. So if people want to hear some examples of some of our students talking about the Platonic texts, then go ahead and listen to, I think it was Digital Dialogue episode 21, if I can be self-promoting a little bit. So maybe we could go back, because you focused on the UNESCO statement about race, and mm-hmm. I think that would be maybe a nice way for us to start unpacking the nature-culture issue and then see how race fits into that.
Mm. Yes, I mean, it's interesting because it was relatively late in the writing of this lecture, because it's a lecture that I've given various versions of in Hong Kong, Rio de Janeiro, and Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. But it was only for the Penn State version that I really came to focus on the UNESCO statement, and yet it seemed to be the perfect way to do it, because it gathered together a lot of the themes that I wanted to address. And I was looking at particularly the 1950 UNESCO statement, mm-hmm. which was produced at the request of the United Nations in order to try and address the problem that Europe and North America, but also the whole world, had in the way in which, following the Nazi Holocaust, they could see how racism was pervasive mm-hmm. throughout the world, and that something had to be done to address it. And partly by accident and partly by design, Ashley Montague from Rutgers University was brought in to do this, and he drafted the statement with a number of excellent other scholars like E. Franklin Frazier and Claude Lévi-Strauss, mm-hmm. that I also talked about in the lecture, and he used this argument that he had developed or been developing since 1942, the argument that first of all, this distinction between nature and culture, mm-hmm. which had been developed by another of Franz Boas's students, first Robert Lowy and then Ruth Benedict, puts biology and anthropology in separate spheres. That meant that the study of nature was separate from the study of culture, and therefore any natural differences, any biological differences between humankinds that might be identified had no implication for any cultural differences. So you could not establish mm-hmm. any secure argument proving it, that cultural differences, whether they be intellectual traits or moral traits or whatever, mm-hmm. Derived from the biological differences. So that was their argument. And then there was a subsidiary argument which Montague had rather less success in 1950 in persuading his fellow committee members to adopt, which is that, well, biology doesn't have any use for the concept of race, and so, therefore we should drop the notion race altogether. What the UNESCO statement actually said is that race belongs to biology, and so other people shouldn't use it.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't understand what the biologists were saying.
And you were uncovering, really, a problem with the kind of divorce that they tried to articulate between nature and culture.
Well, I think that it works at various levels. I think that, first of all, yes, this was a very effective challenge against scientific racism as it was being practiced in various parts of the world in the 30s and 40s. But that it had certain limitations. One was that they seemed to be assuming that at the heart of all racism is scientific racism.
Mm-hmm.
But if that is not true, and I don't think it is true, then it leaves a lot of different forms of racism intact. There is also the problem that this distinction between nature and culture was, as I was indicating a moment ago, just a very recent one.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's seemed to be, when one examines its history, the product of an artificial division that only emerges, in this second quarter of the 20th century. So again, it's not a distinction which is particularly illuminating for understanding the history of racism.
Right. I mean, I guess there are two things we could sort of talk about. One is that longer history.
Mm.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about that because you made some gestures to Aristotle and to Kant and some other figures. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. But the other side of it is something that's happening, I think, also in the early 1900s. I asked you to give some essays to us for the graduate student orientation that I was teaching. You gave us the essay by Elaine Locke, The Concept of Race as Applied to Social Culture. And there he seems to want to hold on to a difference between nature and culture, but then also render it dynamic and problematize it in interesting kinds of ways. So it's already operating, obviously, there for Elaine Locke. So I wonder how that trajectory gets from the longer history into what's really happening there in the early 20th century.
Yes, I think Elaine Locke's essay is a wonderful and largely neglected piece of writing. It was published in 1924 in the Harvard Review, but I don't think many people picked up on it. It was a very general periodical. It was only the second issue of the Harvard Review, and had essays on Byron and Shakespeare and Roman satire. It wasn't, therefore, something that would find its way into the hands of a lot of philosophers. And so it was only really when Leonard Harris, in his important collection, I think, which came out in 1989, that people sort of rediscovered this essay. And I do think it's a very difficult essay. It's very easy, I notice when teaching it to students, for them to come away and look at this and see it as making the nature-culture distinction. But the essay starts off with him criticizing the way Robert Lowy had made the nature-culture distinction.
Right.
So that clearly was not his contribution. Now, it seems that part of what he wanted to say was that, in some sense, culture produces race, which was, of course, by then a very widespread idea. So that it's at one moment, therefore, a reversal of the idea that race determines culture. Culture determines races, for example, one might say, in terms of not just how races are seen, but also who marries whom, has children with whom, mm-hmm. what kinds of people are favored, and so on and so forth, and what mixes are possible. But it's clear that he doesn't mean it simply as a reversal.
Right.
And it's clear, too, that he's problematizing all these notions. And so that's why I think, and I'm not the first person to have said this, that the term deconstruction is not misapplied when you look at what Alain Locke is doing in his essay. And I think to use a word that you yourself used a moment ago, I think, this a fluidity mm-hmm. in the way he's using mm-hmm. These concepts mm-hmm. seems to be really what's at stake for him. And the striking final paragraph
yeah.
in which he brings together all sorts of different approaches and says, we must not just pursue one of these, but all three of them.
Right.
That's the pragmatist tradition.
Yeah, that's pragmatist. And I also think there's an important way in which it dovetails beautifully with the phenomenological tradition, in the sense that, not to say necessarily that Locke was trained in that, but this notion that, as he says, you know, these three, he calls at the end of that essay, three, he talks about three methodological moments of investigation. Mm. And the first one is the analysis and description of culture, of each culture on its own terms, in its own terms. So there's a way in which, and then of course he adds to that, the second moment is the organic interpretation only in terms of the intrinsic values of a culture within an historical account of its development. So the history has to be accounted for. And then the third is the assignment of culture type and interpretation of the stage of culture, at least. That's how he puts it in at the end of that essay. And I found the essay really compelling precisely because he wants to hold on to the difference between, to a distinction between nature and culture. But he wants to problematize the relationship, or at least as I read it, make it, as you say, fluid or dynamic, and in fact, in an interesting way, reciprocal, and so that we can't say, well, race determines culture, and we can't really say that culture determines race, but there's an interesting interplay that problematizes the distinction. But what I found really powerful was he was unwilling to relinquish the distinction.
Right. Yes, nor was he willing to relinquish the notion of race.
Right.
And I think that's, I'm sure, very much connected with his own experience of racism
mm-hmm.
in the United States at that time. And it seems to me that is such an important part of critical philosophy of race.
Right.
That the descriptions of these cultures from the inside as a project, Locke's project, is something that is important if one's looking at the history of racism. Mm-hmm. We have to understand racism from the viewpoint of those who experience it as best we can,
right.
and the different forms it takes. And I think that what was problematic about the UNESCO
mm-hmm.
approach was that there was this sense, which is not unique to them, that they wanted to guard against being racist themselves.
Right.
They wanted to warn their colleagues
mm-hmm.
about being racist, but they weren't really concerned at any point, it seems, to understand what racism meant and how it's experienced and where it's located by the people who are experiencing
mm-hmm.
racism. And when you hear their voices, then one recognizes racism as a much broader phenomenon,
right.
which therefore calls for a much broader approach to combat it.
Right. No, and I think that was what was really powerful about your articulation of the UNESCO document as really, in a certain sense, an epistemological approach. Epistemology understood, I thought, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this, but epistemology, as I thought, understood in almost a disembodied sense, at least because the writers of that document thought, well, we could make this distinct. We should just divorce this nature and culture, and then just say, okay, you know, try to figure out how people would, if they just understood that. That culture is not determined by race. That everything would be okay, and we would be able to move forward. And what I think is really important about what you're saying is that we need an account on the experiential level, kind of even phenomenological account. I think also, obviously, American pragmatism can help in this regard because what needs to be thought through philosophically and also, I think, embodied, because it's difficult. It's one thing to think it through philosophically. It's another thing to live it. And I think that's actually the exciting thing that's going on here at Penn State from my perspective, because we're bringing in a diversity of students and we're not only talking and thinking about the question of race, as well as all the other traditions that we have always been talking and thinking about, but we're trying to live it in a concrete way with one another. And there is, I think there's a richness that can come out of that lived experience that is philosophically very important.
Yes, I fully agree with that. But I'd only want to add that there are these other dimensions, which I think is what the study of racism within a philosophical community can contribute, and that is that racism is, first of all, societal,
mm-hmm.
and not just individual. So it's both experienced and produced at the societal level.
Mm-hmm.
It's historical in the sense that we're dealing with the layers of past racisms as a legacy. So that, there was a time in this country, but not just in this country, where the hostility to the idea of race mixing was perhaps the dominant form of racism. I don't think that would be the dominant form of racism today, although it does surface, for example, mm-hmm. Louisiana person who refused to marry a mixed-race couple, so you see it there. But you have to uncover these different forms of racism to see how racism is not just one monolithic idea. It has these various competing forms, and so in fighting against one form of racism, there's always a danger
mm-hmm.
that you serve to bolster another form
right.
of racism. And I think this sort of question about the notion of race itself
mm-hmm.
and its legitimacy is a classic example of that. In some cases, it's very legitimate and very liberatory to say, well, you know, the term race does not apply here, we don't know what we're talking about, let's get rid of it. And yet in another context, it has the exact reverse effect.
Right.
And that's why when studying racism, it's not just societal and historical, but also local.
Right.
So that's the complexity. And that's something that philosophers have to deal with if they're going to address it.
Right. And and that's also why, from my perspective, it's so important not only to think and write about it, but also to do what one can within the institutions in which one lives and which one represents often, to try to combat that institutional structure of racism that's operating all the time. And I think, you know, one of my, when I went to, in undergraduate, one of my most important classes I ever took was a two-semester class on racism. And it really had a profound effect on me insofar as it was clear that there were certain things. Well, first of all, it was very important to uncover for me the institutional societal structure of racism, so that, you know, it moved me away from thinking of racism as some, you know, kind of personal bias that someone might have and ways of reacting to others, to thinking about the way in which society is structured in a certain way, and our responses are to one another are conditioned by that structure.
Right. And of course, philosophy itself can be understood, when you're thinking philosophy as an academic discipline, as an institution.
Right.
And historically, I think it has obviously done a great deal to promote racism. I don't think all practicing philosophers today are as conscious as they might be of the history of the discipline, mm-hmm. and the dangers of perpetuating some of those effects through lack of awareness of that history. It's really striking to me that we haven't had a real debate on the philosophical canon, for example, mm-hmm. in the way that other disciplines have had. And I think the failure to do so, and the failure to see how many students can be offended by the fact that philosophers teaching today dismiss the racism of the philosophers they're studying as somehow irrelevant mm-hmm. to the job in hand of understanding what they're saying. I think all these kind of things, and one could add many, many more, have led to the fact that philosophy is still predominantly white mm-hmm. In this country. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of work to be done. And I've been very happy that the two universities I've been associated with, University of Memphis and now Penn State, I think have been extraordinarily committed mm-hmm. to bringing about a change.
Yeah. Well, and I think the one of the important things about the approach that we're taking, I think, here is that it has the integrity of saying, look, there's a way in which we can critique the history of philosophy, and there are also resources in the history of philosophy for a certain kind of imminent critique that can be brought to bear. And I hear some of that in what you were saying in your inaugural, and particularly like to ask a little bit about the phenomenological tradition, because you seem to be drawing on a certain strand of that in your inaugural, that I hear, at least. Am I correct in hearing that you want to sort of draw on a strand of phenomenology to perform this critical philosophy of race?
Very much so. I think that certainly when I think about the critical philosophy of race, Frantz Fanon looms very large. Mm-hmm. And his essay from 1951, which was incorporated into the 1952 book Black Skin, White Masks, the essay is called The Lived Experience of the Black, is, I think, a classic example of what using the phenomenological resources of, in his case, Sartre, although he actually also studied with Merleau-Ponty, but using the phenomenological resources of Sartre, he could also criticize Sartre in productive ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that the very productive exchanges that Sartre and Fanon had at the end of Fanon's life, the Fanon's enthusiasm for Sartre's Critique of Dialectical Reason, which led Fanon to invite Sartre to write the preface to The Wretched Earth of the Earth, I think that's a classic example of where phenomenology really shows itself capable of seeing racism as a system,
mm-hmm.
and moving it away from just simply this focus on ideas or phrases that individuals right. use, which is, I think, how racism is so often seen by the media.
Right.
That you can avoid racism if you avoid using certain words or avoid using certain phrases.
Right.
That you just have to police yourself, mm-hmm. and then you can go around saying, I'm not a racist.
Mm-hmm.
But if racism is societal, then obviously it's a much bigger issue.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, one has to say, too, there's a great deal of dirty laundry in the phenomenological tradition when it comes to race as well.
Right.
Ludwig Ferdinand Klaus was a student of Husserl, as was Oscar Becker, and they were both extremely involved in producing, one might say, the kinds of racism one saw under National Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there is the case of Heidegger, which
right.
is very prominent
right.
today.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to actually ask you about that, because you made an interesting point, I thought, at the end, and I don't know if it was an offhanded comment. Actually, I doubt it was. I'm sure you've given a lot of thought to this, but obviously the Heidegger question and Heidegger and race is an important question to face fully, particularly in the context of the kind of project that you're working on. The Emmanuel Faye book has now come out in English, and it has been taken up by the New Republic and Slate Magazine and the Chronicle Review by different authors with taking on different kinds of perspectives. So I wondered if you could say a few things about your approach. Your comment that you made, just to remind you, was that there's something about the notion of Earth, particularly in the essay of The Origin of the Work of Art in Heidegger, that actually allows us in a certain way to understand, to problematize the nature-culture distinction in an interesting way. Now, I myself have done a little bit of work on this, written an essay on Walter Benjamin's work of art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, and tried to compare it to Heidegger's Origin of the Work of Art. And part of my critique of Heidegger in that essay was that where Benjamin tries to argue that the aura of the work of art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction is verfallen, he says, is sort of decays, that there seems to be, in a certain way, a reinvigoration of the aura of the work of art in Heidegger that I found, at least in that essay, politically problematic. But increasingly, as I've been thinking and rethinking and engaged with Heidegger, and particularly with regard to my book on the nature of truth in Aristotle, by drawing Heidegger into relation with American naturalism, the pragmatic naturalist tradition, I begin to see that there is a lot more to the concept of aletheia in Heidegger than the kind of critique I leveled earlier. I'd still want to stand by some of that critique, but I'm interested in what you would say about the Faye book and about this whole controversy.
Yes, it's such a complicated issue, and I have so much I'd like to say.
Yeah.
I have to say, when I read the Faye book when it came out in 2005 in French, and dismissed it because even though he did have access to some texts that the rest of us have not seen, his use of evidence in terms of the texts that we have seen was so bad, and the forms of the argument so exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
That I was quite frankly surprised to see Yale University Press publish it. It's really, as a work of scholarship, not very good. But, of course, the problem is you don't want to attack the Faye book, because it looks as if you're attacking the Faye book as a way of defending Heidegger.
Right.
And there is no defense against... there's no defense for Heidegger. It's quite clear that he was anti-Semitic. Personally, that he was anti-black, and it's also clear that he was far too close to the National Socialists, also in his thinking of race, particularly around about 1934.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe, and here Fay seems to have no inkling of this, that Heidegger, who was attempting in 1934 to rethink the notion of race in terms of the existential ontology of Dasein,
mm-hmm.
Realized that he did not have the resources to do so from out of being in time. And then he introduces the notion of Earth in The Origin of the Work of Art, not just to account for art,
mm-hmm.
But also to account for the notion of the folk. And while he's observing what is going on, not just in National Socialism, because he was always, and again he can be perhaps faulted for the way he saw this, but he was also against what he saw in the West and also the East, mm-hmm. the Bolsheviks, he believed that their notion of race was completely dominated by technology,
mm-hmm.
which means that it was a metaphysical concept of race,
mm-hmm.
a concept of race determined, if you like, by Western metaphysics. And so what I see him trying to do as part of the task of the overcoming of metaphysics, and indeed I think it's part of the inspiration for the overcoming of metaphysics as a task for him, is to twist free of the metaphysical concept of race and to develop another concept of race in terms of Earth. He did not get very far in that, but I think the insight into the relation between Western metaphysics, mm-hmm. and the technologies of race is one that is still worth considering.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to explore some of this in an article which I've just finished, which is going to come out in the Southern Journal of Philosophy, I think, in March,
mm-hmm.
2010, I hope. So perhaps these very sort of schematic and simple remarks are better seen in the larger context,
right.
of the argument.
Right.
But I do think, first of all, Facebook cannot be relied upon. Secondly, nevertheless, it's quite clear there is a huge problem for Heidegger here. And yet, thirdly, the question of the place of racism within Western philosophy cannot be isolated as a Heidegger problem.
Right.
It is a more general problem,
right.
and that's possibly the worst thing about Facebook.
That's actually what I was going to ask about, because it strikes me as you make your point here, that maybe something's going on with the Fay book that's analogous to what's going on with the UNESCO statement, insofar as the idea seems to be, in some ways, and this is perhaps an unfair caricature of the Fay book, but when Fay writes, as he does, for example, on page 295 of the English translation, that Heidegger's work is a monstrous historical and ontological legitimation of Nazi genocide, and then uses these kinds of claims to really ghettoize or attempt to ghettoize the Heideggerian corpus, identify it as the Nazi scholarship and Hitlerism. That attempt to make this division, okay, there's philosophy and then there's this other stuff, is really problematic in the same way that it's problematic when the UNESCO statement says, okay, if we could just divorce race from culture, we would have an easier time of it. Now, I understand there's probably more to the Fay argument than that, but the point that you're making is, I think, an important one to underscore, which is that, you know, this is part of philosophy's history. And coming to terms with it does not mean bordering it off and excluding it in a way that says, okay, now we've dealt with that problem. Okay, just say, like, get rid of all of Heidegger's books, and somehow if we could just purge the tradition of this, I think even one of the people called this babbling philosopher, right, then it would be fine. I mean, there's a way in which Heidegger, I kind of, with the publication of the Fay book, I remember back in graduate school, for me, it was the Victor Farias book. Mm-hmm. And so each generation, in a certain sense, has to come to terms again with this issue in Heidegger. And I think that is a good thing, namely, that we need to come to terms with it, that we, even though it cannot probably be come to terms with. That is to say, it has to be an ongoing attempt to think through the problems that Heidegger presents in an acute way, but that are also operating in the history of philosophy more subtly.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. The strategy of trying to isolate the bad guy, as it were, has been the strategy that's been pursued in a sort of defensive manner since the end of the Second World War. There's a sense in which, I argued recently, you can see it too in Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. You know, and the question has been sort of more generally, you know, who is offered up? Well, do we sacrifice Herder? Do we sacrifice Fichte? But we save Kant, and so on and so forth. Right. But it's far too, it's far more complicated than that, and requires much greater scrutiny. But there's one sentence in Fay soon after the one you quoted on page 300, mm-hmm. which I find extraordinary, because in some ways it shows how little he's reflected upon what he's doing. He says, and he's making the same point that you were talking about, that Heidegger's work never belonged to philosophy in the deeper sense of the term, that that's his thesis. But he tries to rub that in with this sentence: it's not enough to have written on Aristotle, Descartes, or Hegel to be a philosopher. If the basic tenets of one's thought constitute the very negation of the moral obligation to respect the human being as such, independently of his or her belonging to any particular community, people, or race. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, there, with this phrase, basic tenets of one's thought, there is a possible escape route for Fay. But it looks to me as if, by that argument, he's also going to exclude Immanuel Kant, Hegel, Locke from philosophy too. Mm-hmm. And the question is, one would need to throw back at him and say, well, is that really what you meant? Or isn't this just part of this excessive rhetoric that you're engaged in? Isn't there something very dangerous about this line of argument if you're not really going to reflect deeply on what is left, what remains? Mm-hmm. I mean, what's interesting is that, in a sense, is the question that is being pursued by the very intellectual tradition of the very late Heidegger and those readers of him, like Levinas and Derrida and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. who are saying, well, what remains mm-hmm. after we have seen what the West has come up right. with, that the West cannot look upon itself any longer in the way that it used to. It's such a serious question, and it deserves a much more serious treatment than Fay is willing to give it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think one of the ways in which I would hope we can pursue it as we move forward through the use of a certain kind of dialogue. And so one of the things that I think is really exciting about bringing that the continental tradition into dialogue with the American pragmatic tradition as we think about the critical philosophy of race, and also as we think about philosophical issues more generally, is that the idea of just trying to mute or isolate a certain way of doing philosophy, however problematic, right, is not going to allow us to transform the way philosophy is done. And I think there are a lot of resources. I think the Elaine Locke article that you asked us to read, but also I think the American pragmatic tradition, because of its desire to really think itself on the border between different traditions and to reach out to those traditions that are not like it, have some resources to help us in that regard. So I wonder if you had some thoughts about that, that as you move into your position here at Penn State, and hopefully also sort of experience a different kind of pluralism, right? So the here at Penn State, the department is pluralistic, not because it has an analytic and a continental strain so much as it has this American and continental strain. So it's it's an interesting different dynamic, and one that I think is potentially powerful.
Yes, I'm certainly very excited about that, and I think too that American pragmatism has the resources and the temperament, the sympathy to be able to engage in this re-examination of the canon in ways that perhaps other strands of philosophy have not been able to. To do. We need to go back to that attitude towards the history of philosophy that you see in the eclectics of the 18th century, and not simply adopt their perspective. But if you were doing history of philosophy, of course, in Germany in the middle of the 18th century, you would study Chinese philosophy. You would study the philosophy of the Canadians, by which they meant the Native Americans, of course, and so on and so forth. And we've lost that. And I think there are all sorts of ways in which we can do it. One of the things that I've done this semester, I mean, my graduate level course that I've been really excited about, and very excited about the response of the students too. I've just been reading their wonderful essays. And that is to look at the history of political philosophy in the 17th and 18th century, and to think about their responses to the slave trade. Mm-hmm. Why was there such a failure of insight on the part of the philosophers? And of course, that has to be extended to the question of why has that not been an important consideration, or a more important consideration, for historians of political philosophy? Mm-hmm. Why do we not hear about the fact that Bishop Berkeley owned slaves?
Right.
Maybe that's not the best example, but why do we not hear more about Kant's defense of slavery in the 1780s? That this is only just... it seems, surfaced into historical consciousness. There seem to be a lot of very important issues here, and it's going to require a lot of different methodologies, different approaches to really address them in an adequate way.
Well, that's one of the many reasons why I'm very excited that you've joined us here at Penn State to continue that project, to continue to think in pluralistic ways about these issues. So, and thank you so much, Robert, for coming to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it, Chris.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.